In preparing for this, what's happened is the introduction to Zechariah 6, the second half, has become the entire study for this first week to help us get our bearings. So I'll hopefully be back at some point to do Zechariah 6 in reality. But today is more going to be an introduction. And what we're going to do is we're going to essentially trace some Old Testament history, some sort of themes through Old Testament history, to hopefully then, by doing that, build up to the background and sort of lived experience of Israel as to then what the second half of Zechariah 6 verses 9 to 15 are getting at, because there's a lot in there and it can be difficult to unpack unless, if you like, we've been through a bit of the journey of Israel over its history. So that's what we're going to do. But just to get back, I'm going to read Zechariah 6, although, as I said, we won't directly be going through it. We're instead going to be doing tracing a line through Old Testament history. But I think it'd be good to read Zechariah 6, 9 to 15 anyway. So this is Zechariah 6, 9 to 15. And the word of the Lord came to me, Zechariah, take from the exiles Heldai, Tobijah, and Jedaiah, who have arrived from Babylon, and go the same day to the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah. Take from them silver and gold and make a crown, and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold the man whose name is the branch, for he shall branch out from his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. It is he who shall build the temple of the Lord, and shall bear royal honour, and shall sit on his throne, and there shall be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. And the crown shall be in the temple of the Lord, as a reminder to Helem, Tobijah, Jedaiah, and Hen, the son of Zephaniah. And those who are afar off shall come and help to build the temple of the Lord. And you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. And this shall come to pass, if you will diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God. So that's Zechariah 6. Lots of things in there. But this evening, we're just going to do a bit of a history to bring the themes together that Zechariah 6 is touching on. I've done lots of diagrams, again, just to sort of be helpful to people as we go through, because again, these are all themes building into Zechariah 6. So cast your minds all the way back to the Garden of Eden at the very beginning. If you like the bottom left diagram. In the beginning, you've got the Lord and man. They live together, they commune together, and we covered this earlier in Zechariah, in the Garden of Eden. Man lived in the presence of God, and in the dwelling of God, they're together. There's no difference between where they inhabit, and it's a garden, it's cultivated perfection. And man is to extend the borders, he's to push, if you like, the dotted line on my diagram down, to cover the whole earth. There's nothing wrong with the earth, but the garden is cultivated perfection. Whereas the rest of the earth is perfection with potential. It needs to be cultivated, made all garden, made everywhere the dwelling place of God. But man sinned, as we know, Genesis chapter 3. Heaven is sealed shut. The dotted line, if you like, becomes two solid lines. A flaming sword, a cherubim. Don't look at the second diagram yet. The flaming sword and the cherubim cut the relationship off. There is now this gap, this breach between heaven and earth. Man is cast out, and he's cast out onto a cursed earth. Man is separated from God, and there is no way back. That's Genesis 3. Relationship is ruined. Then we get to Sinai and the Exodus. So we zoom forward. The Lord has redeemed Israel from Egypt through Moses. They are his special people, his chosen people, the people of promise. They are the descendants of Abraham. And at Sinai, the Lord and his people enter into a covenant together. The people enter into covenant with the Lord, mediated through Moses. And the Lord descends down on Sinai. So if we take our second picture, the Lord descends on Sinai, a mountain, and we see sort of Eden all over again. We see a holy God, though touching a cursed earth, so this hard line is still there. And we see fire, lightning, thunder, as God descends upon the mountain, because the relationship between God and man is still the same. However, under the terms of the covenant that they make, the Lord is going to dwell with his people. There is going to be, if you like, some terms of relationship, a breach between heaven and earth. A breach is going to be made between them under specific terms in the covenant. And this relationship, this bridge between heaven and earth, contains four key parts. They'll be familiar parts. One is it contains an ark. This is the Lord's throne. It's his presence. It represents his presence amongst his people. You have the tabernacle. Represents his dwelling. It's a house, a home for the Lord. It's where he will dwell, where the Lord, where the people will meet with him. So you have something that represents his presence, something that represents his home. You have a priesthood. These are the people that go between. They mediate the relationship. And they have a role that's both up and downward. They mediate the experience of God down. They tend for things in the tabernacle. And they mediate the people upward. They sacrifice and represent them to God. So you have, inclusively, a form of relationship. You have God, you have a dwelling, a meeting place, and you have a mediation between the two, a bridge between the curse of between heaven and earth. And then you have the law, the fourth component, sets the expectations of the people who bear the Lord's name and how they are to live. Okay, but the first three, ark, tabernacle, priesthood, ATP in the top left, are the three things we're going to look at this evening. But those three things are established, three components of a real relationship between the Lord and his people. So, that sets those three things out. Moses, when Moses mediates the covenant, we'll be familiar with him going up Sinai. Yeah, he goes up Sinai. He only goes up, though, at key points when he negotiates the covenant. It's not necessarily his daily routine. His daily meeting point, Exodus 33, is called the Tent of Meeting. This is where he goes routinely to do things. He goes up Sinai for special situations, such as actually receiving the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone, etc. He goes regularly to the Tent of Meeting. So in the second diagram, you've got a little tent, the Tent of Meeting. This is like a little portal to the top of the mountain. This is a little sliver of Sinai brought down to the earth. Moses can go there, and it's like being up the mountain without actually going up the mountain. It's a meeting point with God. When Israel sin, and they have the golden calf, and the Lord proposes to send them off, and he says, I will send an angel before you. I'll still, you know, the promises will still be fulfilled to some degree, but I will send my angel. I can't be amongst you. I'll break out in a moment. You remember that passage, which is after Exodus 33. Moses obviously intercedes on their behalf to reconstitute things. Well, the going or not going would have been very visible, because the whole idea was to get this tent into the people, to bring God's dwelling into the people. So them going would have been leaving Sinai and leaving the tent behind. No ability to meet with God. So when the relationship's reconstituted and they start again, and Moses mediates the covenant a second time between the Lord and his people. In Exodus 40, what happens? This tent, with all the protections and barriers defined in the terms of the covenant, this terms of relationship, can now be brought into the camp. So in Exodus 40, it tells us that the tent of meeting is put into the tabernacle. And it literally becomes one and the same thing. There's no distinction from that point forward. The tabernacle is the tent of meeting under terms that means it can be with the people. When it couldn't be with the people, it was in the desert, far off, estranged. But under the terms of the covenant, it can come in, and it looks a little bit different, it behaves differently, because that's the terms under which it can function amongst the people. So when we leave Sinai, we have a relationship with God, because we have a tabernacle, a tent is in place amongst the nation. There is an ark, God inhabits it, and he is going with them. And we have a priesthood that's functioning, that allows the people to be mediated to God. And the third diagram. So when they leave, they have a real relationship. It's still under the terms of the old covenant, but it's a real relationship. what happens now if we cast our eye to the timeline across the top. We're going to see what happens from Exodus. So they're at Sinai. What happens next? Well, next they get Shiloh. Next we get to Shiloh. This functioning relationship for a period of time, about 47 years, is nomadic. So obviously they journey through the wilderness. The Lord is with his people. There's a priesthood, a tabernacle, the ark. It's functioning. All those things are happening. For 47 years they go through the wilderness and they conquer Canaan. So 40 years wilderness, 7 years to then conquer Canaan. At which point they settle in Shiloh. So the tabernacle is then established in Shiloh. It means house of peace. They build the tabernacle there, and it becomes, if you like, a tent in Joseph. Yeah, Ephraim is where Shiloh is. Ephraim is the tribe of Joseph. Sometimes in one place in the Bible it refers to this as being the tent of Joseph. It's where the tabernacle is first set up. And it remains here, and I didn't realise this until you sat down and worked it out, for 350 years. About that length of time. Yeah.
Sorry, just wondering, what is the little box in the third diagram?
Behind
the priest.
Oh, that's the ark. Okay. Sorry, that's fine. Never had a question during a session. Well, that's exciting. So that's the ark. Okay. So it sits in Shiloh for 350 years. So from Joshua 18, verse 1, through to 1 Samuel 4, 350 years, the Israelites function with a priesthood, ark, and tabernacle, all in Shiloh, all functioning in Shiloh. And to put that in a bit of context, the Temple of Solomon, that we probably mostly think about, only had the ark in it for a little bit longer than 350 years. So a massive amount of Israelite history has a functioning tabernacle in Shiloh. Okay, just to get your perspective. But then what happens after 350 years? We have the Philistines. As we know, over the period of Judges, the nation declines. It declines rapidly, it declines badly. And we have that crowning event in 1 Samuel 4 of Hophni and Phinehas. Eli's sons, wicked sons of Eli, Eli the high priest. They retrieve the ark from Shiloh. Ephraim is in the sort of middle east of Israel. They take it out of Shiloh, they transit it to the west where the Philistines are, and they treat it in the same way the Israelites would have done during their wandering in the wilderness, treating it like putting God to the test. If we put God at risk, he'll have to defeat the Philistines, like he did when we were wandering through the wilderness. We carry him around, he has to defend us, because otherwise he is lost. So they put him to the test. But of course the battle is lost. Remember in 1 Samuel 4, Israel are defeated, the ark is captured by the Philistines, and it goes around various cities. But more happens. If you remember, news gets back to Eli, his sons are dead, and he then dies. And he's already been told that his house as priests has been rejected in 1 Samuel 3. So he's told he's rejected as the priestly line. He now dies in 1 Samuel 4. His sons are dead in 1 Samuel 4. The ark is gone in 1 Samuel 4. But even more happens. If you follow the ATP line, you'll notice something else happens to the T, the tabernacle. 1 Samuel 4 doesn't tell us this, but Jeremiah 7 does. It tells us that the tabernacle is violently destroyed in battle. It's generally, this is universally accepted as being the Philistines at the same time the ark is lost and Hophni and Phinehas are killed. So Jeremiah 7 tells us that at the same time as the ark is lost, the priests die and are rejected, the tabernacle itself is also destroyed violently. It's laid ruin to. So 1 Samuel 4, all is gone. The whole established order has disappeared. Yeah, it's all gone. What was established at Sinai has evaporated, eradicated. And we enter this period of broken relationship after the Philistines. The tabernacle, the Israelites rapidly rebuild it in Nob. So you remember, if you cast your mind back, it's referred to during Saul's time about the ark being in Nob and then in Gibeon. What actually happens, they rapidly rebuild it in Nob after the destruction. So they rapidly rebuild this tabernacle in Nob. The line of Eli continues. The priesthood actually reestablishes itself. Even though it's rejected, they continue to serve in Nob. And that continues to happen all through the rest of the life of Samuel, all through the time of Saul, and even through all of David's reign. That carries all the way on to the Solomon bit, all of David's reign. That still functions. There's no ark, but there is a tabernacle that's rapidly rebuilt, and there is a rejected priesthood that still tries to function. What happens to the ark? Well, the ark, after being around in Philistia for a little bit of time, several months going around the cities, and you remember they are cursed, so they suffer lots of illness and disease. It moves around the cities and it comes back to Beth Shemesh. Remember, the Philistines put it on a cart. They put the milking cows at the front, and they just send it off and say, if it's of the Lord, of Israel's God, it'll go straight back to Israel. And of course, they low and they go straight back to Israel. They end up at Beth Shemesh. The inhabitants take the ark off. They then go and put it in Kiriath Jearim. And it will remain at Kiriath Jearim all the way through the rest of Samuel, all the way through the rest of Saul, and also through the first 7 years of David's reign. The ark remains there. So dotted lines, rejected lines, the ark wandering about the land. And then we get to David and Jerusalem. And here we enter a very strange period of Israelite history. Very strange period. We'll call it the Tale of Two Tents. Like the Tale of Two Cities book. A Tale of Two Tents. Very strange bit of Israelite history. David conquers Jerusalem. So there's a civil war for 7 years, and he reigns in Hebron, just over Judah. He then conquers Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul. The whole nation unites around him. He then conquers Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is built on Mount Zion. So there's three mountains around Jerusalem. Mount Zion that is on. There's Mount Moriah that happens later, remember. Then there's the Mount of Olives, which is the largest one, slightly further away. Jerusalem is built on Mount Zion. David captures Jerusalem on Mount Zion from the Jebusites. He makes it his city. He calls it the City of David. He makes it the capital of Israel, the centre of Israel, literally in the geography of the land. It's easily defendable, an excellent capital. And what does he then do? He then goes and retrieves the ark from Kiriath Jearim. It's up here. He goes initially to retrieve it. And you remember there's this false start. They put it again back on a cart pulled by animals, and it wobbles, and Uzzah puts out his hand to steady it, and Uzzah dies. They then put it in the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months, and Obed-Edom's house prospers. David then goes back because of this and tries again. He goes and gets the ark from Obed-Edom's house, and he transits it, this time properly, into Jerusalem. And it's with great fanfare and celebration. And he does something very odd. You sometimes may not think it's very odd at the time, but it's very odd. When he brings it into Jerusalem, into his capital, he puts in his own tent. His tent doesn't follow any old covenant prescriptions. It's just a tent. In fact, it looks like this tent, where Moses just opened the curtain and walked in. That's like David's tent. It's just a tent with a curtain that you walk into. It follows no Old Testament prescriptions at all. It even has Obed-Edom. So Obed-Edom, whose house it was in, David makes him the guardian at the door. Obed-Edom is ethnically a Philistine, so he originates from Israel's enemies. David has lots of Gentiles and non-ethnic Israelites in his kingdom. Obed-Edom's one of them. But he's a Gittite, he's a Philistine. He's guarding the doorway to God's, to David's tent where the ark is. David also behaves oddly. He behaves like a priest. He establishes himself essentially as a high priest. He mediates on behalf of the people through sacrifice. He blesses them, mediating God's presence to the people in the way that the priest did inside the tabernacle with the showbread, etc. He comes, he brings out the food from the Lord, he distributes it amongst the people. However, whilst all this is going on, just this picture here, you've got the king's palace, you've got the Lord's tent that David set up, the tent of David, and you go, it's all in Jerusalem, there's no protections, there's none of this, gubbins with barriers, there's no old covenant prescriptions, and the people, if you like, live in the city immediately outside the tent, even with Gentiles around them. But of course, whilst all that's going on, so that's, if you like, up here, you've got David's new tabernacle here, you've got his priesthood here, because he even conscripts his own priesthood, most of whom are Levites, and they support him as high priest. So they, you've got the ark and you've got his ones. However, these are still functioning. So back in Gibeon, you still have the existing priesthood functioning. David obviously alludes to this when he sins with creating a census. The whole functioning tabernacle is there. That's still there. So from Jerusalem all the way to Solomon's temple, you've got two tents in Israel. Two functioning priesthoods. But one has an ark and the other doesn't. One has old covenant prescriptions and guards and protections, the other doesn't. And the one without the ark has all the prescriptions, the one with the ark has none of them. A tale of two tents in Israel. Well, then we get to the temple, Solomon's temple. As you know, David goes and wants to build a permanent dwelling for the Lord towards the end of his reign. Nathan, if you remember, comes to him and says, "That's an excellent idea, David." And then the Lord says to Nathan, "No, it's not a good idea, Nathan. Go and tell David not to do it." Remember that narrative? So David wants to build a permanent dwelling for the Lord in Jerusalem. He's forbidden. God promises David that his son will build a permanent dwelling. His heir will build a dwelling for the Lord in Israel. But it can't be him. And what happens? There's Solomon. Solomon appears. It's David's heir, David's son. He takes all of David's savings for building the temple. He follows David's instructions. And he builds the temple for the Lord in Jerusalem. So we have a temple being built. We have a new temple. So this tabernacle disappears and we now have a temple in Jerusalem. Okay. And what Solomon does is he takes all the paraphernalia, I'll call it that, from this tabernacle, and he puts it in the temple, and then he takes the ark from that tabernacle and puts it in the temple. So he takes the ark from one tent and puts it in the temple. He takes all the paraphernalia and all the old covenant terms and put them back around the ark. Okay, so the Jerusalem now has a permanent temple for the ark. Eli's family, they're removed. So they've always been rejected all the way since the Philistines arrived on the scene, now over 100 years earlier. But they are finally removed. Eli's great-great-grandson, that's roughly his generational descent, he is defrocked by Solomon. Zadok is put as the new priestly line. Post that point, most people do genealogies of priests from Zadok, because Eli is rejected. He becomes the new priestly line, and Zadok. So you have now, if you like, the relationship here, feels a bit like the relationship even here. The permanent temple with an Aaronic priesthood, and the ark is now present in its place again. So we have now a functioning relationship. Things are restored. And the Lord recognises this when the Shekinah glory descends. When Solomon dedicates the temple, and the Shekinah glory descends on the tabernacle, representing the Lord as re-inhabiting the dwelling place amongst his people. Then we get to Babylon. Babylon. The nation has declined again. Things have continued to descend. It feels very Judges-like. Things descend quite rapidly. David is the pinnacle, the high point, the man after God's own heart. Solomon starts well and he descends. The nation is then obviously taken away from David's line largely and is divided. And then the northern 10 tribes, as we know, 722, they go into Assyria and they disappear. Judah sort of peaks and troughs over that post that. It eventually descends worse than the northern tribes, and it itself is judged by God and descends, and then is captured and goes into exile. And what happens? The ark is again gone. It's captured, it disappears. There's no further reference to what happens to the ark post that. The permanent temple of the Lord that Solomon builds is raised to the ground and destroyed by fire. And the priesthood is again rejected. We covered this a bit when Zechariah 3, where You have the vision of Joshua being reinstated, or at least reinstated as a sign, not necessarily reinstated in the sense we would think of the Lord as being priest. He's reinstated in a symbolic way. But he's reinstated because the priesthood has been rejected at Babylon. But more than that, at Babylon, the king who'd come on the scene. So David was a king, the kingly line getting all the way to Babylon. The king is also forsaken. Jeremiah 22, Psalm 89, the king has also been thrown off. The signet ring's been discarded. And we covered this under Haggai, we did the prophecy of it being put back on again. So Babylon is a big moment. All the hard line, all the things are ending. Which brings us then to the return and the rebuild. So 70 years of exile, we get to the rebuild of the temple. This is where we're at. So they return after 70 years. The rebuild is occurring. There's obviously that hesitating start. And that's when we get to Zechariah 6. Hopefully people followed that, because we've got some critical questions this asks. Hopefully as we went through, maybe you were thinking of these sorts of questions. Some essential questions to try and make sense of all this history. So you've got these three components tracing back to Old Testament history. This picture of the Lord's relationship with his people. And the sort of real way, because obviously it's not just pictures, this is a lived experience for the Israelites, the real lived experience as to how God represents that relationship to them. And they have a real one, because the covenant defines a real relationship. Had real blessings and cursings for their behaviour. He had a real presence of the Shekinah glory on the ark. It wasn't a fake thing, it wasn't a pretend, it was a real thing, a real terms with a real relationship. But this history, this flow, raises some questions, doesn't it? Raises some questions. And this will help unlock Zechariah 6. What really happens at Shiloh? What's really going on when the Philistines arrive? Why does the ark never go back? So when the Philistines come, why does the ark wander about in Kiriath-Jearim, then Obed-Edom? Why does no one bother taking it back to the tabernacle that's been re-erected in Nob and Gibeon the entire time that it's there? It never goes back. Why does no one take it there? Why does David not take it back there? David, you're the man after God's own heart. Surely you understand the terms of the covenant, what the ark represents. Why are you putting back God back in what would appear to be his house? How can the ark reside in a tent of David's own making and under his own terms? How can that be allowable? How can this period of history actually occur? It doesn't make any sense. And why does the tent of David disappear? If David could build this tent, why does it get abandoned? Now, this is alluded to coming back in the New Testament and in the Old, but why does it then get abandoned when the temple comes along? What's going on? Well, let's look at these questions. What's really happening at Shiloh? What's really happening with Shiloh and the Philistines? And when I was preparing for this, I thought this is like almost the bit of Old Testament history that passes us by. I don't know if you ever thought this when I was going through Shiloh, Philistines, there, I remember Eli. We don't really think of it, I don't think particularly. But what's going on with Shiloh? Shiloh is significant in Old Testament Israel. It's significant because the ark is there for almost as long as it was in Solomon's temple. And what happens is a hugely then consequential part of Israelite history. Shiloh's destruction, the ark being captured, the priesthood's rejection, are all bound up in a pivotal moment, which is alluded to initially in 1 Samuel 3. When it talks about the fact to Eli, and says, what I'm about to do with Shiloh and the Philistines isn't going to be any normal defeat of Israel. This is going to be the thing, the Lord says, will make everyone's ears tingle. This will be truly shocking and unheard of. Because it's going to be the Lord's rejection of an old order. The whole order up to the Philistines is going to disappear. It's going to be rejected, forsaken. Jeremiah 7:12 tells us that Shiloh is where the Lord first put his name. The Lord didn't just put his name at Jerusalem, he also put his name, Jeremiah 7, at Shiloh. That's where he put his name first, before he put it in Jerusalem in 1 Kings 8. Psalm 78 tells us that Shiloh, and what happened there, was God's judgment against Israel and its wickedness, because he could no longer be amongst them. He in fact describes it, Psalm 78 says, that God voluntarily exiles himself from his own people. The Philistines wasn't just a battle as a bit like, oh, that's Hophni and Phinehas shouldn't have done that. And the Israelites are very wicked. This is God sort of making an example of them. No, no, the Lord is actively choosing to abandon his people and exile himself from them. And go into foreign territory, rejecting the old order of how everything was functioning. Psalm 78 tells us he's rejected, he has now permanently rejected what he called the tent of Joseph, this tent in Ephraim, the order that was functioning in Shiloh. It's not just a defeat in battle, it's not just a period of history where the ark is captured. It's the Lord rejecting the whole order of things up to that point. And things are going to change from that point forward. Why does the ark never go back to the tabernacle? In one sense, it's quite obvious, isn't it? Now, because Nob, Gibeon, the other locations, Eli's descendants, they're all rejected. They're no longer legitimate. That's the relationship that God exiled himself from in the nation. So the ark doesn't go back there because Israel forget about it. Why go to the ark? Where's the ark gone? I don't know. They're not wandering around wondering where it is. This is by design. God has exiled himself from the nation. He has no intent in going back to the tabernacle that was in the land of, in the tribe of Joseph. That's the rejected order. And thus, whilst that old rejected order remains as a shadow of its former self, he remains exiled from it. He never goes back there. Well, David then, why didn't David take it back? Well, David would be for the same reason. It's a rejected order. God has no intent in going back to the tent that was in Joseph, in Shiloh. But then how can David take the ark and then make it reside in a tent of his own making? How can he do that? Well, again, Psalm 78 tells us the Lord in David is choosing a new order of things. The Lord has rejected the tent of Joseph and he is going to interact with the people differently. He forsakes the old order and he says he is now choosing a new shepherd for Israel. David. David is the man after God's own heart. The Lord has now joined himself to his king. Before the Philistines, that was not the case. But the rejected order means God now comes and has united himself with his king. And the Lord now goes with his king, the shepherd he has chosen for Israel. So when David conquers Jerusalem and makes it his, what does he do? Well, the Lord is with his king. So he brings the Lord into Jerusalem to be with his king. The Lord goes with David. He returns from his self-imposed exile, not back to the tents of Joseph. He comes back to be with his king, his chosen shepherd of Israel. And where does he put his name? He put his name in the same place as his king has put his name. In Jerusalem, on Mount Zion. You notice from this point forward, the Old Testament's focus shifts, doesn't it? It focuses now on this experience. Everything is about the David reigning in Jerusalem, or the Messiah in Jerusalem, or the Lord reigning on Mount Zion. Because the king and the Lord together is how the Lord's new order is being established. That's why David is able to set up his tent, because the Lord is now with his king. So the king reigns in Jerusalem, so the Lord joins him and reigns in Jerusalem. It's no longer the forsaken tent of Joseph under the terms of Shiloh. That remains as a shadow of its former self. But the Lord has established a new relationship through his king. And he joins his king at the centre of his people. Now, David's never commanded to do this. I couldn't find anywhere in the Bible, anyone referring to anything where David is commanded to set this up. But David knows exactly what he's doing. He knows what he's doing and why he's doing it. Psalm 110, a psalm of David, talks about David's own role as being a king priest. Hence why he knows he can act like one. He recognises the significance of what he's doing and the relationship that he as king with the Lord has and his mediation of that relationship to the Lord. And he's obviously doing that whilst existing in this state on the top of Jerusalem with the Lord. His behaviour is intentional. He knows exactly what he's doing. He recognises the office that he has. He recognises he is with the Lord. And he has set up his own tent to do that. David's tent's also different, isn't it? In Shiloh, you have all these boundaries and protections that they're set up to protect the people from God lest he breaks out against them. But in here, you don't have any of those protections. In fact, you have a Gentiles in his kingdom, even at the very door of the tent that David has set up. They're involved in its interactions. His tent enables them to approach the Lord. The Lord is establishing a new order from Mount Zion. He's forsaken Shiloh. That's why David is comforted when Obed-Edom is blessed, because he's living in the presence of the ark as a Gentile, but the Lord blesses him, not break out against him. That's why he renews his confidence to keep doing what he's doing. Well, then why does the tent of David disappear? If this is the order of things that Psalm 78 says the Lord is re-establishing, he's forsaken Shiloh, he's joined to David, and this relationship appears to be blessed, why does it disappear? At the end of David's reign, you have two tents. You have the forsaken tent functioning with the Lord absent, and you have the occupied tent of David. But there's an essential issue, isn't there? It's a critical problem that is faced. Tents are temporary. Tents are temporary. Remember when David talks about building a permanent place for the Lord? And the Lord says, I like something temporary. It means I can go wherever my people are. Something easily dismantleable, easily left, easily moved around. Tents are temporary. Buildings are permanent. Buildings are permanent. David, he's restless, Psalm 132, for the Lord. He's passionate for the Lord. He's passionate for the Lord to dwell with his people. But the terms of the relationship they actually currently have is still defined by a covenant set at Sinai. David, he can't build the ark, he can't build the temple, the permanent building, but a son will. But they're still under the terms of Sinai. So who's his son? It's Solomon. But Solomon is a son under the old covenant. He doesn't have a different relationship to offer. So Solomon can build a temple, yes. He can build a permanent dwelling for the Lord, yes. But he can only build it under the terms of relationship that he's the heir of. And he's the heir of David, but he's an heir of the tent of Moses. So he can only build what he's able. So he builds his temple under those terms, a permanent dwelling, and he puts the ark in it. Perfectly legitimate. He builds what he's able. It's legitimate. The ark is there. The Lord descends. The priesthood's established. It's a covenantal relationship. But there is not yet an heir to David's tent. There's an heir to David as king. There's not an heir to a different relationship. So a tent can work for David, but he can't build its temple. He doesn't have a relationship for that. So the tent of David is vacated. There is no heir to it. There's an heir, to Sinai, and so it can be built by its king. But there's not an heir to David's tent. So the tent disappears. The Lord's king reigning with the king in Jerusalem, the Lord of all nations, in a relationship with God, with no boundaries or restrictions, for now, disappears. Isaiah 16, Amos 9, talks of this tent coming back again. It says, in the days, I'll raise up again the tent of David as in the days of old. But for now, there is no heir to the tent of David. But do you notice now, this is where we come to a close. I think the introduction will be an entire study, didn't I? So we come to a close. Do you see now the significance in the scriptures of this whole period? Why everything talks of reinstituting this? Old Testament prophecy is filled with what? Micah 4, lots of other places, bringing back not the temple of Solomon. It's about establishing the tent of David on Mount Zion. Remember, Solomon's temple is actually on Mount Zion, it's on Mount Moriah. Okay, David's tent is on Mount Zion. It's all about bringing back this. Yet the Old Testament weight and all its focus, all its promise, is not the recovery of this temple. It's all the recovery of the David forever. Mount Zion, Jerusalem, the Lord and his king reigning together. The Lord of all nations, all peoples. When Amos 9, which we'll read at the end, it talks of the enemies of Moab coming in and being part of Israel with the Lord. They're not referring back to this, they're referring back to this. The climax of this history, as we travel forward, is when does this really appear as a temple? When do we build something that's under a different relationship? When, after 1,000 years, 1,000 years of God relating to his people through fire, judgment, condemnation, of trying to get a portal back up Sinai, where all we do is we have Emmanuel for a period with the ark, then God exiles himself, then he comes back again, then he exiles himself. Why? Because we have a period of relationship, then we fail. There's a period of relationship, then we fail. When will this end? When we will have a relationship that isn't defined by borders, boundaries, judgment and Sinai? When do we have this permanently? When will all of this history be recovered? They couldn't fit it on here. With not Emmanuel exile, but an Emmanuel forever. When we don't have any of this, when will that come? Amos 9 says this: in that day I will raise up the tent of David, not Solomon's temple, the tent of David, that is fallen, and repair its breaches. I will raise up its ruins, I will rebuild it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the nations who are called by my name. It's no longer this. This. The whole Old Testament is building to this. An end of this up, decline, up, down, decline, judgment, 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 destruction, destruction, destruction. When will we get the tent of David and Emmanuel forever at last? And we'll find out in Zechariah 6, 9-15. We'll stop there.